For the week of June 26th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 109, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm... Oh, I don't care. I don't want to talk about it.
Wait, why are you so depressed, Michael?
Well, because this week in entertainment, for the first time in history, we saw something I hoped we would never see.
Which was what?
A bad Pixar movie.
Okay, I thought you were going to say a fantastic weekend at the box office.
No, for the first time in history, a Pixar film got bad reviews. Cars 2 opened strongly at the box office, but got universally bad notices from critics. And they'd never even come close to that before. It was a remarkable run. No one in film history, no studio, no director, no actor, has ever had such an unbroken run of critical and popular success as Pixar had. And now it's still continuing its run of popular success, but it has clearly and unequivocally stumbled for the first time among critics, and it's a shame.
Well, don't you think that, I mean, Cars, the first film, didn't...
Cars was universally considered, I think, the weakest Pixar film. Other people might have felt it was A Bug's Life, or some people weren't big fans of Monsters, Inc., mainly me. There were some movies there that weren't huge critical successes, like those three films, but they still got pretty darn good reviews. This movie got bad reviews. Thank you, Mater, for ruining Pixar's run.
Right. Well, we will definitely be talking about Cars 2 when we get to box office. On today's show, we'll also be talking to Chris Baker. He's a talented young man. He's an author, a copywriter. Actually, he very well may be the best example of a multi-hyphenate I've ever seen. And he wants to send M. Night Shyamalan back to school. Back to film school, that is. And actually, I went to film school with M. Night, so it'll be very interesting to see what he has to say about that. Cars 2, as you mentioned, raced to the top of the box office this weekend around the world. Did you get that, race to the top of the box office?
I got it.
Okay,
I got it.
Just checking. That might be a better pun than most of the jokes in Cars 2. It was the first sign, as you said, that there is a chink in Pixar's armor as the film was panned by critics. We head back over to China for some additional movie news. Hulu is for sale, Michael, so in case you had any interest in buying the video streaming website, I don't know how much money you've got on you, but, you know, if you're interested, it's for sale.
Start rolling those quarters.
Yeah, and I'm going to thank you in advance for trying to explain a whole bunch of theater grosses to us, because as I was going over the show notes this weekend, I thought, my God, am I paying my taxes here? There are more numbers in these show notes than I've ever seen before. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
All right. Well, the number one movie at the box office worldwide was, in fact, Cars 2, which opened to $111 million around the world. Also number one in the U.S., of course. And basically, if you're a Pixar film, you're going to gross between $50 and $70 million on your opening weekend. Cars in the U.S. did about the top range of that at $68.2 million, I think it was.
Cars 2, and you mean. Cars.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's a big hit. Never mind that the critics didn't like it. Number two at the box office worldwide was Green Lantern, which fell hard. It grossed $47.8 million around the world. At number three worldwide was Bad Teacher, the raunchy R-rated comedy starring Cameron Diaz and Justin Timberlake. That grossed $43.9 million worldwide. At number four was Kung Fu Panda 2, which grossed another $41 million. Its worldwide cum is just about to hit $500 million. At number five is Super 8, which grossed $22.6 million worldwide. The J.J. Abrams film, which cost $50 million to make, has now grossed $116 million around the world. At number six, Hangover Part 2, which grossed another $21 million worldwide. It's at $572 million and counting. At number seven, X-Men First Class, just under $20 million worldwide. Its cum around the world is $318 million. At number eight worldwide is Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides, which grossed another $18.2 million. The international gross is 3 1/3 times what it grossed at the domestic box office. It's just a smidge under $1 billion, which it will pass this week or next weekend.
Yes, and we will undoubtedly read about 500 headlines about that, I'm sure.
Absolutely. At number nine, Bridesmaids, which grossed $16.4 million worldwide. It's still opening quite slowly overseas, but it has grossed $160 million so far around the globe. And at number 10, the Jim Carrey family film, Mr. Popper's Penguins, which is open mostly in the U.S., but starting to open overseas. It grossed $15 million worldwide.
Well, I know earlier this year, there were a number of exhibitors or movie theater owners that I was talking to that were really disappointed, at least here in North America, in the movies, and they were really fretting that they weren't making a lot of money this year. Not that they weren't making as much money as 2010, because they knew with Avatar they wouldn't, but they weren't making any money. I think that they should be quite happy with results like this. You got Hangover 2, which has made $572 million worldwide. That's half $1 billion. You got Pirates of the Caribbean about to pass $1 billion. Green Lantern, okay, not a huge success. In fact, it dropped 70% here in the U.S. This weekend, with Bad Teacher coming in number two. But these are good grosses.
This year is filled with box office success stories, movies that were made for a certain price and proved very profitable at the box office, no matter what it was compared to this weekend versus last weekend of the year before and all that sort of junk. Any theater owner who's fretting in February about the box office grosses is an idiot.
Remember, they look at it as, you know, probably going all the way back to October of last year.
I'm looking at it from a common sense, intelligent perspective of a businessman who can't expect every year to be the biggest year in box office history. If that's what you expect, you're a fool. And if you look at the trend decade by decade, you see box office has grown tremendously well. It's a very strong business. And if you're not quite keeping pace with the second biggest year in box office history, that's an absurd reason to panic. Does that sound like a reasonable approach?
Yes, because I was talking to movie theater owners. And here's what they're saying. They're saying, great. So one half of my business is, you know, doing okay and doing better than the rest of it. However, look at Cars 2, for example. Cars 2 had the lowest attended opening for a Pixar film. Or I think it was the lowest attended.
Ticket sales are also keeping pace both with population growth and with the box office. Ticket sales, this idea that ticket sales have plummeted, nobody's going to the movies anymore, is ridiculous. Ticket sales have increased decade by decade every year since the 50s.
Well, we're going to be talking about this on a future episode. But what I'm referring to is, well, and Cars 2 Weekend was towards the back of, according to Box Office Mojo, towards the back of the pack for a Pixar film. Attendance-wise, it was ahead of only A Bug's Life, Ratatouille, and Toy Story, the original. So I guess what I'm saying is you're looking at it from a theater owner's perspective. Remember, they make, let's say, $1 million. They get $500,000 back to the studios. So that's one half of their business.
That's always been that way.
Right.
That's meaningless. They don't get to keep every penny that they make at the box office. We know that.
Right. But they do get to keep what they make in concessions. And if fewer people are going, they look at life in a sales per person ratio.
You know what they should do? They should drop 3D, because only 40% of ticket sales went to Cars 2 in 3D. 60% of their customers did not want to see Cars 2 in 3D. They avoided it. They went to trouble to find a 2D screen, which is what I tried to do over the weekend.
Good luck.
They don't want it. They don't want to pay an extra $3, $4 for a ticket to a show to see it in 3D. So if they want to get more customers in the seats, stop doing 3D, or at very least, stop charging a premium for it. Say, hey, if you're going to come and eat popcorn and soda, we're thrilled. Enjoy the movie in 3D.
Well, wasn't it just a couple weeks ago that we were talking about Jeffrey Katzenberg or what he said about 3D, that every industry tries to upsell its clientele and that, you know, they didn't turn the entire plane into 3D. They turned, you know, just one little section into, and he tried to compare it to airline travel. And if you're going to do that, then fine. Then look at airline travel. How many seats do you have on a plane that are economy as compared to how many seats you have that are first class?
Right. Plus, you look at amenities that they provided in first class, and now you see every seat has a screen with a whole banquet of entertainment options. You know, if you can provide it to all your customers, you should.
I don't know. I tried to see the film this weekend, and I really had to think about whether I went to see it in 3D or not.
What did you do?
I did go see it in 3D because I thought, you know what? It's a Pixar film. I'm taking the kids. They don't like wearing the glasses. It cost me $40 for three tickets. Three tickets, $40.
If they don't like the glasses, why did you make them see it in 3D?
Because, I was going to go, I had to see it, and I was going to see it in 3D.
So, and how was the 3D?
The 3D, actually, you know, for Pixar, they know what they're doing in 3D.
Yeah.
They're quite good at it. I mean, it's natively produced in 3D. You know, it was good. The film, on the other hand, went way over their heads. I mean, what was the first film about? Did you see this film, first of all? Did you see Cars 2?
No, I missed it. I tried to get to the theater. The subway was not running. I had a jam-packed weekend. I was going to baseball games. I was getting The Right to Marry. I was going to see Cirque du Soleil. So, you know, I had a lot going on this weekend.
So, yeah, just overcoming years of discrimination.
And I showed up at one theater. I said, oh, I want to catch this now. And I was about 4 minutes late. The movie had just started, you know, when I went to the box office. I know the feature film had just started. So the next screening was an hour and a half and away, and the subways weren't running, so I ended up going home earlier.
My God, that's more involved than Cars 2.
Was it I'd seen the first original Cars. Which
and what
was, sort
the,
about,
what was the first original Cars about?
Well, it was had a slow pace. It was about taking your time and appreciating life and, you know.
Yeah, the guy basically had to build a road in a town that he destroyed, right? I mean, that was, that was the you know, Lightning McQueen was stuck in this Radiator Springs town and he had to rebuild the road. Very simple, very understandable for children under the age of 10. This film, and I know this is not a movie review podcast, but this was ridiculous. It hinged, it was basically a James Bond film. With Mater being kind of, you know, this anti-spy. He didn't really know he was a spy for most of the film. And it had to do with alternative fuel and the bad guys were, you know, trying to get gasoline used again. And there were so many characters and so much was going on. Trying to explain it to a five-year-old was impossible.
That's a bizarre, since the movie is geared towards little children.
I know. It was absolutely... maybe they want kids to see it again and again. I have no idea. I look at this and say, Mr. Lasseter, either direct a film or run the studio. Because, of course, he runs Disney Pixar. But trying to do both just did not work.
Well, it's a shame. I thought with Cars 2, they would solve the make a better movie than they did with Cars 1. So that's a shame. But they're certainly going to make a lot of money in the store.
Right. I know that's one of our stories. Before we move on to that story... Transformers 3 Dark of the Moon, Michael Bay on his blog said, Dark of the Moon has some of the most technically challenging sequences ever shot, because of course I'm not egotistical and I would say that, and it's shot in 3D. I must urge you to find the very best theater and see this movie in that format. 3D was a forethought, not an afterthought in this movie. I'm glad Jim Cameron and Steven Spielberg really convinced me to shoot in this new technology. We used and invented many new techniques to make the 3D sharper, brighter, and more color contrast. I think theater owners heard their audience that they need to respect the specs of the projectors and not dim the bulbs to save money.
Well, that's a very geeky reference to theaters showing movies with dimmer, keeping the bulbs down dimmer so that they don't burn out quickly and thus not showing movies to their full glory.
Right. Well, but I also think he's trying to say, go see it in 3D. Pay as much as you possibly can to go see my very expensive movie.
Yeah.
But speaking of people who are making money, Woody Allen, Midnight in Paris, that film just won't quit.
Well, his movies usually have long legs. It's finally passed his two biggest hits of recent years, Vicky Cristina Barcelona. Oh, Barcelona. I had a friend who yelled at me for using the Castilian pronunciation of Vicky Cristina Barcelona and is now going to approach, hopefully, Hannah and Her Sisters as his biggest domestic hit in history.
Yeah, I mean, it made another $4.5 million this weekend. Of course, we're talking about biggest hit in history here in the U.S., right?
Right, meaning about $40 million. So this is not a box office blockbuster kind of guy.
Right. Now, you were talking just a moment ago that Cars 2 might not be a critical success. And I saw the film and there were some really funny moments in it. And it was fine for adults. I mean, I can understand adults.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, it was fine. I could follow it. But for kids... it makes it, unenjoyable for both the parents and the children. But I don't think it will slow down the critical failure of Cars 2. I don't think it's going to slow down their merchandising.
No, I mean, it's a $2 billion business right about now.
Well, $2 billion per year. So it's made $10 billion since 2006 when the first Cars was released.
Right. And of course, now they have a whole bunch of new characters from around the globe, you know, sporty cars from Italy and strong cars from Germany and things like that to market to kids, not just in America, but all over the world. And they'll keep coming fast and furious, I'm sure, for years to come.
I know. The Wall Street Journal and the Los Angeles Times had a story about this. I wonder if they'll actually, part of the characters in Cars 2 were lemons, like Pintos and Yugos and Gremlins. I try to explain what a lemon is to a six-year-old and a four-year-old. Good luck, especially while the movie's playing. But I wonder if they'll have those cars.
I don't see why not. I mean, if they think they can make money off it, sure.
Who knows? But these days, with DVD sales dropping, and, you know, I guess the studios overexpanded when DVD sales were going through the roof, and they would make, you know, as much money in DVD, actually two or three times the amount of money on DVD as they would theatrically. They kind of overexpanded, and now they're paring back. But they're also looking for... new revenue sources since DVD sales have dropped off a bit. Films like Green Lantern, films like Cars and Cars 2. these films make, you know, $2 billion a year in merchandise.
Well, I don't know how much Green Lantern is going to bump up merchandise for that property, but
not
ever
much.
Ever since, you know, long before even Star Wars, but certainly in the modern era, Star Wars kicked off the idea of merchandising tie-ins, and it's just a given for a big summer blockbuster, especially one geared to families.
Yes, yeah. I mean, it's just remarkable to me. $2 billion a year. The Wall Street Journal had this figure. Disney has been especially aggressive this year, allocating 80% of its production budget to films that will have merchandising tie-ins, which is up from 40% in 2010.
Well, you know, that's I don't know how they're judging that. I mean, almost every movie has some sort of tie-in, a poster, a CD, something. So, I mean, it's...
No, they're talking about $2 billion worth of tie-ins.
Well, they're not, they don't know that these movies are going to make $2 billion in merchandising. They're just saying they have the potential to sell a lot of toys for some of their movies.
Toy Story made $2.8 billion in merchandise last year. That's amazing, don't you think?
No, because the third film in the trilogy came out. It's one of the most popular film trilogies of all time. Incredibly critically acclaimed. A gold standard of characters, and it's been an evergreen for years now.
Okay. All right. Fine. I'm trying to add some excitement to the podcast here.
Well, let's go to China. That's exciting.
Yeah, I guess, you know, maybe.
Well, we spoke last week about a Chinese film director, Zhang Yimou, who's making a movie with Christian Bale as his star. And some of the details weren't clear, but a few more have emerged, and we thought we'd clear up what the deal is. The film is called Nanjing Heroes, and it hasn't been finalized yet as far as the title is concerned. But the Associated Press reported that the budget is $90 million, not the $100 million we heard before, but that would still be a record for a Chinese film. It's based on a book called The 13 Women of Nanjing and tells the story of 13 prostitutes, or if you prefer, sex workers, who volunteered to replace 13 college students who were conscripted as comfort women for the invading Japanese army. Christian Bale plays an English priest, and the movie took about 6 months to shoot. So it's obviously a gripping, serious drama. Be interesting to see how the movie does.
And Zhang Yimou is just a great filmmaker.
Well, he has been a great filmmaker, though it's been a number of years since he's made a great movie. He got sidetracked by the Olympics and some spectacles that weren't up to his standard, but certainly had a run of truly great movies.
Well, absolutely. Heroes was pretty good, don't you think?
Again, early in his career, he had a tremendous run of great films. I feel like the quality has dropped off quite a bit in the last 10 years. But, you know, I'm sure we all have movies of his we like or don't like.
Wow, you're tough.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm tough. I'm not as tough as the Communist Party, though. They've made a movie called Beginning of the Great Revival. And by God, if you're in China, you're going to see it.
Or you will pay one way or the other. That's for sure.
That's right. They have a film that details the history of the founding of the Communist Party. Basically, if you're a big star in China, you will star in this film. Chow Yun-fat is in it. John Woo and Andy Lau loaned their talents to it. It's the second in a series. And basically, you're expected to go attend the movie. You have to go see the movie. That's, you know, companies will buy a bunch of tickets and send their employees to see the film during the weekday. Schools take students to go see the movie. It is sort of a guaranteed box office hit. And in fact, they've been holding off on some Hollywood releases and telling people, until our movie hits this certain number, we're not going to show any other movies. So, you know, if you want to see the next, if you want to see Cars 2, I guess you have to go see Beginning of the Great Revival.
Right, which, as you said, it's the second in I guess it's a historical epic they're trying to...
That's right. It's basically a propaganda film,
right,
but done with better values. And people are buying tickets, but they're not necessarily going. There was an LA Times article about this, and they described people mentioning that you'd have a ticket and you would pay for it, but you wouldn't actually go see the movie. They went to see the film in, I think, Beijing, and the theater was, you know, three quarters empty, but it was sold out. So
right.
That tells you people are, you know, buying the ticket but not necessarily going because it's probably not that good a movie.
Kind of like baseball games here in the U.S.
That's right. You buy a ticket, but it's the rain doesn't look good, or, you know, you're just not in the mood and you end up not going.
Right. I mean, so really, you mentioned it already. Local newspapers keep running articles touting how many people have seen the movie. And then you have all of these theater owners, going back to theater owners again for a second, where they are pushing out Kung Fu Panda 2 or Pirates of the Caribbean early to make way for this movie.
Well, they have no choice.
Yeah. I mean, in the first 5 days, this movie accounted for 50% of all the tickets purchased in the country.
Right. It made about $18 million, which is a huge amount for China. Doesn't mean that people went, but they did buy their tickets.
Yeah. I mean, they're predicting that it's going to make $92 million at the box office, which would be one of the higher grossing films in the Chinese language. And I guess now what they're saying is, gee, what's it going to do overseas? Will it do anything overseas? I don't think it's going to do. I would go see it just for sheer curiosity, but I guess it opened this weekend here in the U.S.
Yeah, no, it's not going to make any money.
Yeah, I mean, it cost $10.8 million to make.
It's very hard to make a good film via a government agency.
Well, it's very hard to make a good film, period.
That's true. There have been examples, though, Why We Fight during World War II, and John Huston and John Ford and Noel Coward in the UK, people who contributed to the U.S. effort, the international effort to defeat Hitler. And there were some really good propaganda films made under the aegis of the government, that or films made through studios that had the full cooperation of the government, that were clearly intended as propaganda, but were also very interesting, good movies. Yes, I guess if under democracy, you have a better shot at it.
Well, you're not forced to go see the movie, that's for sure.
So happily in America, we're not forced to go to the movies, but we are forced sometimes to diagram sentences and deal with grammar, which is something I hate.
Yes, well, and quite frankly, you very well may have to be forced to go see an M. Night Shyamalan movie these days.
Well, oh, now you're confusing me. Now you're making my head spin. Let's stick with the grammar. Our guest this week is Chris Baker, who is the co-author of the book, The Elements of Effing Style, A Helpful Parody, which comes out on July 5th. It's $10 in paperback or in an ebook version. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
You've got a lot of stuff on your plate. You are the creator or co-creator, I guess, of a website called The Effing Word of the Day. And we do have kids listening to this podcast, amazingly enough. That's why we're not actually saying effing.
Oh, great. Thank you very much. Now it's extra editing work. Thank you.
Now you have to beep that. But it's a website, Word of the Day. But you basically what you do is you use words in a sentence, but you use modern context so that it's not so boring and it's easy to remember. Like recently you had a word that referenced the Jersey Shore because the word was pullulate, which means to exist abundantly or to have a lot of. And the sentence you used to describe the word or use it in a sentence was, this club is pullulating with what Pauly D might call grenades. And so The idea behind the website was that when you use, that's one of the few sentences I could read on air, by the way. So the idea is when you use a word in a sentence that people can actually know what it means and it's sort of contemporary, it's easier to remember what the word means and how to use it in a sentence. And you've taken that idea and put it in this book, which is called The Elements of Effing Style, which I imagine your publisher or for legal reasons you call a helpful parody. But it's not a book of jokes. It's really a book about grammar and style and word usage. And you just use modern contemporary examples to illustrate that.
It was just based off of the insight that when learning is incidental rather than prescriptive, it doesn't feel like learning, and it can be actually quite fun, and the memory actually kind of works better, you know, when things are funny.
Exactly. And the book covers everything that the elements of style might, like grammar and usage and the difference between further and farther and envelope and envelope. And you give a lot of different examples, most of which, again, we can't quote on the air. But it's a book that you could give to a teenager and they might actually read and enjoy.
Yeah.
Right. Here's one. It says, it's about the use of a colon, you know, and how to use a colon to split a preposition from its object. Now, here's the wrong way to do it. A decent homemade sex tape requires colon, good lighting, comma, attractive participants, comma, and a tripod. Now, that's the wrong way to do it. The right way to do it is a decent homemade sex tape requires three things, colon, good lighting, comma, attractive participants, comma, and a tripod, which, you know, very subtle. And yet, all of a sudden, I can remember when to use a colon.
And Chris, I don't know, with all the home sex tapes I've seen, I don't know if attractive participants is actually necessary because most of them don't seem to involve that.
Yeah, well, we're trying to change that too.
Good luck.
Yeah. So you've got the Effing Word of the Day website. You have this new book, The Elements of Effing Style, which comes out July 5th. Who is your publisher?
St. Martin's Press and Thomas Dunn Books. Which
terrific.
Is,
And you've got other things that you do online as well. The first thing I think that caught Sperling's eye was a website about sending M. Night Shyamalan back to film school.
Yeah, that was a pretty interesting project. Well, I do a lot of side projects outside of my 9-to-5 job.
What is your 9-to-5 job? Because I think you may have more hyphenates in your career than anybody in Hollywood.
I work in advertising as a writer. I work for an agency called BBDO, which is here in New York City.
So a little tiny small agency then. Nobody will ever heard of them.
they're actually quite large.
Yeah, the inside joke there was that they're one of the largest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, strangely, you know, anyone who's outside of the advertising world, like no one's ever heard of these agencies and they all have you know, acronyms for their names. But it's a pretty big place. It was actually, you know, if you look at the Wikipedia article for BBDO, they're basing Mad Men off of this agency. And like, it's been around for, you know, 100 plus years, and it's in Midtown, and there's a bar there, and they have a bartender that's been working there for like 40 years. It's crazy.
So, I mean, do you ever, you know, is your goal to maybe work for Sterling Cooper Draper Price?
No. I actually don't watch Mad Men, but I think I'd probably work there just so people understand what I do, you know, when I'm drinking at a bar.
That's like an agent not watching Entourage.
Is there not enough cursing in Mad Men for you to watch?
No, I usually find myself getting into series like once they've completed the whole thing, and I can just sit there, you know, and burn 2 weeks of my life just watching every episode back to back. I don't like the breaks in between seasons and the cliffhangers.
So you're starting to watch The Wire and MASH.
Yeah. Gilligan's Island.
Yeah. Well, what was the point of the M. Night Shyamalan website?
Yeah. Now, you should explain what it is first, because it's kind of an interesting... Now, you got a lot of press for this back in, I guess, March and April when it first launched. But yeah. What is it exactly?
So it's mnightschool.org, and it's the movement to crowdsource enough money to send M. Night Shyamalan back to film school. And basically, we were looking for $150,000, which, you know, we estimated was pretty much enough for 4 more years at NYU, Tisch School of the Arts.
Which, by the way, incidentally, I went to Tisch School of the Arts with M. Night.
Did you?
Yes. I may have learned more, although I haven't made, you know... 6 or 7 blockbusters, so maybe I should shut up.
Well, hopefully no one creates a website trying to send you back there anytime soon.
Well, is the site a parody site or just to get hits for advertising, or what was the point of it?
No, it was an earnest attempt to raise the money to send him back to film school.
You know he's not going to go back, and what would you do with the money if you raised it and reached a certain level?
Well, so that, you know, we had a plot twist baked into the whole thing. And the plot twist was, like, obviously this guy's not going to take the money. He's a multimillionaire. Hollywood lets him do whatever he wants. He's obviously not going to go back. So what we wanted to do was take the money, make one of those giant checks, kind of embarrass him on the red carpet, get that out of the way, record that, put it up online. Fun little video, you know, presenting M. Night with a giant check. But then what we wanted to do was give this story a good ending, because his stories have terrible endings. So we were going to, like, hold a small film festival here in New York City. And, you know, we would accept submissions from kids who maybe didn't have enough money to go to NYU. But they, you know, they wanted to be a filmmaker. And we would judge these videos and maybe find one kid who really had the talent and the brains and the drive to go. We'd give the money to him. So it would turn into, like, this kind of nonprofit plot twist on the whole M. Night Shyamalan story. But we only made it to $693.49.
So close.
Yeah.
Are you still collecting money? I mean, can you still raise more money?
Yeah. The site is still up. You know, donations kind of trickle in. We had copy that said, you know, if everyone just gave $1, then it would only take 150,000 people. The problem is the site got so much press that everyone got the joke when they read it on TMZ and Perez Hilton and, you know.
Didn't click over.
Yeah. So the press kind of actually ended up working against the site, which is kind of weird if you think about, like, you know, how that all works. It's, you know, everyone wants to get press, but in this case, it hurt us.
Right, because basically the joke was told in the coverage of the website. Right.
So how did your bosses feel about you doing a mocking of a film director who maybe they'd want to have direct an ad at some point or someday? Was that ever an issue?
No, that didn't come up. You know, BBDO encourages side projects, you know, anything that makes the people who work there look like these really creative people who do awesome things. And sometimes they get behind a side project. Like, I did this thing called letterbombing on Facebook. I don't know if you guys saw that.
Oh, yes. Yes, I did.
Like, that whole thing started as a side project that, you know, my friend Jeff Greenspan and I did. And then BBDO saw it, and they used it for a client. And, like, we won a bunch of advertising awards for it. And it was just, like, one instance of, you know, a side project being used for work.
Well, it doesn't seem like you can do a project without being interviewed by somebody, you know, in the press, because you did this website called The World's Most Exclusive Website. And what is that? Why don't you fill us in on what that is and why I can't get in?
Okay, so the world's most exclusive website.com is just a picture of like a bar on the Lower East Side, like a dark alley, like very kind of mysterious door with a single call to action on it that says sign in with your verified Twitter. And for those who don't know, verified Twitter accounts are given to
celebrities,
you know, celebrities, people of social significance. But there's no way to like get a verified Twitter unless Twitter gives you one. So they end up like when Howard Stern got on Twitter a couple months ago, you know, he got like a million followers in an afternoon. So obviously Twitter sees that going on the back end. So they reached out to him and, you know, they call you and they'll verify that you are in fact this person. And then you get a little blue badge next to your name. It's just become like when having a Wikipedia page on yourself was big, like a few years ago. It's just like the new social status. It's like the new black card, basically. So we created this website where you can only get in if you're a verified Twitter user. And it's, I don't know if you guys know what's on the inside of the website, but people, you know, we've had probably almost 180 verified accounts sign in. Ryan Seacrest signed in, Kim Kardashian signed in, a whole bunch of other people.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, what is on the inside?
So basically, you know, this whole thing, when this project launched, everyone who didn't have a verified account was tweeting to people who did, saying like, please sign into this site and tell us what's on the other side. And so eventually celebrities started going in, like Ryan Seacrest had a whole blog post and he showed people what was on the inside. So what's on the inside is when you make it past this first door, you're presented with another door and you're inside of another room with another call to action that says proceed to a more exclusive room, but only if you have 5,000 followers. Now there are 10 rooms in total. Kim Kardashian has made it to room 7. So she's actually gone the furthest in this. And basically the 10th room, literally only Lady Gaga can get into the 10th room. Justin Bieber and Lady Gaga can get into the 9th room. And then Lady Gaga, who has like 500,000 more followers than Justin Bieber, is the only one who can get into the 10th room. And then once she gets into the 10th room, it'll trigger an event, which I'm not going to say. It hasn't been triggered yet. But once she goes into that room, something happens. So Bieber's people actually got in touch with us, and he was talking about logging into the site. He hasn't gone in yet. So basically, like Kim Kardashian, you know, got through the first door, the second door. And then when she tried to get into the 8th room, she, you know, which required 8 million followers, she has just under 8 million. There's a pop-up that comes up and says, you do not meet the requirements for entry. Please remain here until you are more popular.
Oh, my God. So, but is there anything, you know, what's in the rooms?
Or nothing, nothing. It's just about being popular, Sperling.
Okay.
Yeah, so at the top, you see a list of everyone who's made it this far, and it tells you, like, who's here with you. So if another person is in the room with you, there's a little blue dot next to their name, and you can, like, It'll link out to their Twitter handle, so you can click on them and interact with them.
So thank God we can bring the Kardashian and Howard Stern together in the same room. It's so nice to know that they can get together for a change.
Yeah.
So you've got a lot of different projects, obviously, and your day job with BBDO.
You don't sleep, apparently, because you have like a zillion and a half websites.
Yeah.
You're writing a book. You
blog. The book comes out July 5th. What's the next step for you? What's your next goal as far as a TV or a fiction book or a film project? What do you have that you'd like to do next?
So my next book will be The Degenerate's Essential Lexicon, which will be like 1,000 words you should know. And that'll be more closely based on the effing word of the day.
Now, out of curiosity, when you went into St. Martin's Press and you were sitting there with the highfalutin publishing types who, you know, are very learned and, you know, I don't know what you would call them. You know, they're high art in a way. And you were trying to explain this book and you were using the effing word every 5.5 seconds. What did they say?
Well, actually, I never met them. You know, what you do when you sell a book is you get a literary agent, which is actually very difficult to do unless you create a blog and they approach you. you get an agent and you put together a book proposal, and it's like 40 pages. You include, you know, the first couple of chapters. You talk about the market. If you have an audience already, like we had, you know, a small audience from Effing Word of the Day, you know, you talk about how many hits your site has, how many Twitter followers, all that stuff. And then basically your agent sends that to, you know, 20, 30, 40 editors, and they look at it on their Kindles. And so you never really interact with them except through that process. So I didn't have to go in and like formally pitch the idea, which would have been nerve wracking.
And then when you told your mom, hey, your mom and dad, hey, guess what, guys, I am going to be an author. I am publishing a book. My book is going to be published. And they said, well, great. What's it about?
Yeah, that was an interesting conversation. what's more, you know, they know all my side projects, so they already knew about the blog.
And your mom curses like a sailor, to be honest.
Yeah, my parents are cool. I'll put it that way. they're good drinking buddies, really. At this point in my life, that's all my parents are. we just have fun and get drunk and tell funny stories.
Are you friends on Facebook?
Yeah, but they don't go on there very much.
Okay.
But what's actually more interesting is when they have to tell their friends, like, oh, what's Chris up to in New York City? And they have to explain, oh, he's got a book coming out. Oh, that's great. Well, what's it called? And then they have to drop the title. And, you know, of course, the other person just stops in their tracks and says, oh, well, that sounds like a good idea. You'll have to get me a copy.
Well, listen, Chris, thank you so much for taking the time to tell us not only about your book. It's out, as we mentioned, July 5th, The Elements of Effing Style. And of course, the website is mnightschool.com. You can find out more about Chris Baker by going to ilovechrisbaker.com.
Or ihatechrisbaker.com. I like giving people the option.
Oh. Are they different sites or is it the same site?
Same site.
Okay. Well, I can tell you that you will get lost on that site for at least an hour or two, as I did. Chris, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks
a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that was good of Chris to stop by. The book is actually, I've read parts of the book. I haven't read the whole Elements of Effing Style yet, but it is actually a useful grammar book about words and usage and the difference between when to use yours and when to use Y-O-U-R apostrophe S. So, you know, if you're a liberal-minded parent, you've got a teenage son or daughter that likes to curse, you might just think this is the right book for them.
Curse, have sex, and do drugs. Those are the three things that you really have to do to read this book. And
yeah, they predominate in the examples that they use for every word, absolutely.
Now, before we move on to television, I guess this would be an interesting transition. One more thing.
Ah, okay.
Yes, I think you know what I'm talking about.
You're making a reference to the passing of Peter Falk,
yes,
the actor who portrayed Columbo for many years. As I put it, whenever he would be interviewing a suspect, he'd ask him some questions, and they'd think he was a bumbling fool, and then he'd start to leave the room and they'd say, just one more thing. And then he'd ask him a question like, why didn't you sleep in your bed? Why didn't you turn on the headlights on your car? And they'd say, and they'd realize he was smart and knew what was going on. He, of course, played Columbo among many other roles. He died over the last week. 83 years old in his home in Beverly Hills. There are worse ways to go.
Yes. I mean, he had Alzheimer's. So
did he have Alzheimer's?
Yes, he did.
Oh, I didn't know that. You're sure about that? Okay.
Yes, I am.
Along with, of course, the iconic role of Columbo, he starred in movies like The Princess Bride, The In-Laws, and Wings of Desire. So a terrific actor, and now he's gone.
Yes. Very sad to see. You might be able to see some of his films or even Columbo on Hulu. I don't quote me on that. I'm not sure. But if you could, they're certainly worth checking out. And Michael, do you use Hulu?
Almost never.
Almost never. You know, I used to use it a lot more than I do now. And I think that's actually very true of that website in general. But Hulu is the web video site that was started by Walt Disney and News Corp. Or actually, it was started by Fox.
It was a consortium of...
Yeah, it was like Universal, Fox, and then Walt Disney bought into it.
Yeah, it's Hulu's where you can see TV episodes like a week or 10 days after they air over the air.
Right. And last week, I guess Yahoo approached them and made an unsolicited offer to them to buy the website and buy the company. Chief executive Jason Kilar, chief executive of Hulu, that is, he says that they're on track to do $500 million in revenue this year. They tried to go public last year. That didn't work. But they've been under the thumb of these three big multi, national conglomerates, these media bigwigs, and they've been kind of fighting them a bit, trying to get content out of them.
Of course, their competition now is that everybody has their own website, like HBO To Go or Disney or other people want people to come to their own website rather than Hulu. So there's sort of a tug of war between the interests of the individual companies and what makes Hulu as good as possible.
Right, and they have to compete with Netflix. And frankly, I'm sure Fox would like people actually watching the shows on their television sets because that's really where they make the most money.
Just like NBC Universal.
Right, which is now owned by Comcast.
That's right. So they're looking, they're up for sale. Somebody approached them and now they're a player and now they're talking to people about seeing if somebody else might want to show interest in purchasing them.
Right. And so, you know, I think that the board over at Hulu, they said, well, we weren't thinking of selling, but we may as well think about it now. And as a matter of fact, we may as well entertain more offers, maybe from bigger players than Yahoo.
That's right. Hulu has always felt like something that might go away at any moment. Whether the sale will help them long term or hurt them, I'm not sure.
Right. Well, and there's also the question of, if Disney and Fox or News Corp and Universal, NBC Universal, sell Hulu, right now they have complete control over it. They can pull content whenever they want. They don't have to sign these licensing agreements, these restrictive licensing agreements. They can pull it whenever they want. New owners could decide to become direct competitors.
I don't know what you mean. They have to license the material, so they can't.
Right, but they could actually go off and kind of create what Jason Kilar wanted to create, which is kind of be more of a cable or satellite service.
You mean a competitor to Comcast or competitor to Time Warner Cable, things
right,
like that?
They can actually start showing other content. They can say, NBC, thanks for all your content. Disney, thanks for all your content. We're going to go over to MGM and show their content too.
Well, Hulu doesn't just show those three people, do they? I thought they showed all sorts of content.
They do, but mostly it's those three.
Well, because other people don't want to give it to them, not because they don't want to use it. No?
Right. Yes, correct.
So, yeah, Hulu could be up for sale. It's always had a certain tension built into it because of the three main owners of it and their competing concerns, both for their own networks and for Hulu itself. So this could mean a whole new stage of evolution for Hulu, or it could disappear forever.
Right. Stay tuned. We'll let you know. Stay tuned. Get it? That was my little pun there.
Ah, there you go.
But now, I mentioned that we had some theater news at the top of the show, and so we should get into it. Just some really quick bits here.
Well, there's some big casting news and there's some bizarre casting news. The big casting news is a new play called The Mountaintop, which opened in London last year or the year before, and it's now coming to Broadway. Samuel L. Jackson will be playing Dr. Martin Luther King, who's basically in a hotel room working on his big I Have a Dream speech. And a maid, a mysterious maid, comes in with dinner, and we find out something more beyond that. That's the setup of the play. They've just finally cast the maid, who is going to be played by Angela Bassett.
Who played Tina Turner in What's Love Got to Do with It, for those who are scratching their heads going, who? That's who is.
They know who Angela Bassett is. She's a big star. So this play comes to Broadway. It starts previews in September, opens in mid-October. So that's an interesting new development.
Yes.
At one point, they were talking about maybe Oprah taking that role. People were thinking maybe Oprah will do it because we know Oprah wants to do a play. But Angela Bassett is the pick, and she will be in it. She originally, the role was going to be played by Halle Berry. It looks like she hadn't committed to it, but she had to drop out for personal reasons, and now Bassett has the part.
And then apparently everybody else, every other kind of well-known actor or semi-known actor, is going to star in another play, or it's a series of three one-act comedies, relatively speaking, which were written by Woody Allen, Elaine May, and Ethan Coen, the filmmaker. And they're going to be directed by John Turturro. They're going to go preview September 20th and open on Broadway October 20th. And half the world is starring in these things.
I don't know. I wouldn't describe this that way at all. This is a really bizarre low-rent casting. Basically, it's a trio of one acts coming to Broadway. Big names, obviously, in the writing category. Woody Allen, Elaine May, and Ethan Coen. All big, big stars and draws, you know, arguably on Broadway and off. But the casting sounds like people you would put in a show 2 years into its run. They may be talented people at some point in their lives, but to be the lead people in this hot property is very bizarre. You have Julie Kavner, who does a voice on The Simpsons. You have Steve Guttenberg and Marlo Thomas are the three big names in this show.
I've always been waiting for Steve Guttenberg to make a big comeback. This could be it.
This sounds like bizarro, low-rent. This is ridiculous casting. I mean,
I don't think my sarcasm is working today.
I'm sorry, they didn't get big theater names who could really, you know, deliver the material since you already have the draws of the people behind it, Woody Allen, Elaine May, and Ethan Coen. Nor did they get big stars who are draws on Broadway. They didn't get a big name hot actors who could pull in people. They brought in these people who are sort of past their prime in their career. If one of them had been in this cast, you'd say, okay, they must be really good for that role. That's interesting. But to have all three of them, it just, it strikes me as odd. These are not big names by any stretch of the imagination to anyone.
Do you need big names to make money on Broadway these days? That was my little transition note, by the way.
Yes, you do. And of course, even the big name can be the property of the show, which is, of course, Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark. That's a big name just because of the show itself. There was a whole new article in the New York Times about the cost of the show and how much it costs to run it. It looks like we're hearing that the show costs maybe about $1 million a week to run, which is down from the $1.2 million we were hearing a few months ago. But they say the prices have leveled out, the cost of what they're doing. They have a slightly smaller cast backstage, and they've simplified the show.
So plus, they keep killing people, so, you know.
Yeah, $1 million a week is a ton of money. It's probably the highest weekly net ever. But they are making about $1.2 million a week at the box office. So in like 50 years, they will be in profit.
Exactly. I was going to say, so it'll have to run until we're all old and gray before you see a dime.
That's right.
But now, last week or the week before, we talked about what a Tony is worth and long-running shows on Broadway. And now there's about three pages worth of notes here that we have.
Well, I'm gonna summarize it very quickly. Yeah, we were talking about a New York Times blog post saying, what is a Tony worth to a show? And I had a lot of issues with the article and the way they wrote it and what their metric was. And basically what it comes down to is two things I've learned. One is that we wish we could look at movie ticket sales going back through history, because we think the best estimate of how popular a movie is, did you buy a ticket to see it? We'd love to know how many tickets Gone with the Wind sold and every movie going back through history, but we just can't do it. It's not available. But that's sort of the best comparison for movies from different eras. You know, how many tickets did Jaws sell in the 70s? That's a lot better comparison than box office gross or even box office gross adjusted for inflation. It just doesn't exist, however. But in the theater, we do have that sort of comparison, and that's how many performances a show runs. Once a show doesn't have fans paying tickets anymore, it closes shop, obviously. But you can look at shows and see how long did they run. And if you can go back to the 30s, and when you list the top running shows in Broadway history, you get a mix of shows from the 90s, the 80s, the 70s, back to the 20s and 30s. So even though you get weighted more and more towards recent history because shows have longer and longer runs and there are fewer shows on Broadway, you can really compare shows from a different era and say, oh, look at Tobacco Road or Life with Father back from the 20s and 30s and My Fair Lady in the 50s and, you know, Cats in the 70s and 80s. So you get a really great comparison of shows throughout Broadway history by looking at how long they actually ran on Broadway. It's a really great way to compare shows from the 2000s and how they stack up to the great shows
in
Broadway.
So in the end, what do we have?
And so now we want to say, what is a Tony worth? Does it help you run longer on Broadway? And basically, it's the wrong question to ask. The question is, if you're a big box office hit, are you likely to win the Academy Award for Best Picture? And the answer is no. But if you're a big Broadway hit, if you're the big smash hit musical of the season, you look like the show everybody's talking about, are you likely to win the Tony for Best Musical? And the answer is absolutely yes. Tony loves a big winner. They love it. And so when you look at the list of Tony winners throughout history, you see that the big show of the season quite often wins the Tony for Best Musical. And when they don't, it's just because there was another really big hit that won the Tony for Best Musical over them. They may have been a bigger hit, but, you know, they were two blockbusters and one blockbuster beat out another.
So like in 2004, Avenue Q beat Wicked, and Avenue Q ran for 2,534 performances and ranks, I guess, 21 on the longest running shows in history. And of course, Wicked is still going.
Wicked is still a hit. It's in the top 20 and counting. It's been on Broadway for 3,100 performances, so it's a huge hit. But again, they were both hits and they won. So if you look year to year, you look at box office for Broadway and box office for Hollywood movies, if you're the biggest hit in town, chances are you'll win the Tony. And if you're the biggest hit in the movie theaters, chances are you won't win the Oscar for Best Picture. It can happen, but it doesn't happen that often. It happens about once every 4 or 5 years.
Hold on, I'm just going to write that down. Don't make popular movies.
Okay. That's right. Don't mean not if you want to win the Oscar for Best Picture. That's absolutely true. It happens 16 times in history. A movie has been the biggest grossing movie of the year and won the Oscar for Best Picture. You know, some movies are just inevitable, like Titanic and Rocky and The Sound of Music and Gone with the Wind. And more recently, The Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. Those were all the biggest hits of their year and they won the Oscar for Best Picture. But even being the biggest grossing hit among the nominees doesn't mean you'll win Best Picture. Even that can work against you. So the best thing to do is to be a hit, but not too big a hit, and you win an Oscar. But if you want to win a Tony for Best Musical, by God, you know, make all the money you can. Be the Book of Mormon. Be the show everyone wants to see. And chances are you'll win the Tony for Best Musical.
Well, so then what you're saying is then Harry Potter and the 910 or whatever the next one is called.
HP7P2.
Right. Okay. HP7P2 has no chance at all of winning Best Picture this year.
Right. Just like Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. It's one of only 8 films in history to gross $1 billion worldwide. It won't even be nominated for Best Picture.
Well, do you think that's why J.K. Rowling is continuing the Potter series? Well, not continuing the series, but she's definitely staying in the world.
She is staying in the world. A lot of authors who create fantasy worlds end up with a ton of material. They know, you know, details about little side countries that are mentioned in passing, or she can tell you the history of Quidditch. She can tell you all sorts of things that don't get used in the books, but it's material that she's thought about and written down and compiled, and she's decided to share it with the world via a website called Pottermore, Pottermore.com. She sort of teased it recently. You can submit an email, or at least you could submit an email, to try and get an early sneak preview of the website. But that got so overwhelmed from people around the world that they've shut that down for a while. On Harry Potter's birthday, they're going to give another little glimpse to the lucky few on July 31st. And then in October, the site is going to launch for real. She spent 2 years working on it. It's extremely elaborate and basically will immerse you in the world of Potter. You can, you know, go to Hogwarts, choose a house to where you want to be studying at school, buy a wand at Oliver's, play around, and most of all, delve into all sorts of the arcane material that she's developed during the years, and encouraging you to write stuff and send it in and be a part of the Harry Potter world. But that's what the site was pitched to as the world. But sort of the interesting thing about it was that she also said this site will be the only source on anywhere in the world to get ebook and audiobook versions of Harry Potter books.
Really?
Yes. I mean, she sold hundreds of millions of copies of her books. They've never released them digitally.
Right, that I knew. But I mean, why not give them to Amazon and Barnes & Noble and everybody else?
Well, she doesn't have to.
Yeah, I guess so.
You know, you get more money if you do it yourself.
At least for now. We'll see how long that lasts.
What do you mean?
Meaning, you know, 15, 20 years from now, she might, you know, decide.
Oh, release them. Sure, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. They might decide it's not worth the bother. Ultimately. And of course, it is a lot of bother. It's technically difficult. You've got to set it up for all sorts of different devices. It's complicated, but she's a billionaire or a 100 millionaire, and she can afford to do it. And she wants to do it. And so the publishing world is telling everybody, no, no, no. Stephen King's not going to start selling ebook versions of his books online. This is not a precedent. This is just Harry Potter. This doesn't mean anything. Nobody's going to start doing this. We won't let them. Please don't make this a precedent, is basically their attitude. Most authors, of course, do not own the digital rights to their own books. It's part of their publishing deal. It's shared with the publishing company. J.K. Rowling happened to come at the tail end of the era when digital rights were not automatic, and she did it in the UK where they were even less on the ball. And so she retained the digital rights. It's a little unusual. Almost every big name author you can name does not own the digital rights to their books. So this is unusual, but it's interesting that she'd be doing this.
So it's kind of a big deal then.
It is a very big deal.
In fact, since it's such a big deal, we should move on to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and decide whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. If kids want to buy violent video games, California can't stop them. In a wildly anticipated ruling, the Supreme Court voted 7-2 that a California law banning the sale of violent video games to minors was illegal. The court ruled that video games fall under the First Amendment, just like movies and books and theater and music, and that the state had no business deciding who should have access to art. In other words, if you think your teenage son or daughter is too young to play Assassin's Creed or Grand Theft Auto, the court believes that a decision for the parent to make, that's a decision for the parent to make, not the state. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it is a big deal just in the sense of acknowledging video games as an art form, just like all others. And for people who say it's terrible that a kid should be able to walk into a store and buy Grand Theft Auto, I say, well, where did your 14-year-old kid get $60 to buy a video game? You should be aware of what books they're reading, what music they're listening to, and what games they're playing. That's the job of a parent, not California. But what I love about this is that the two dissenters in this opinion were Clarence Thomas and Stephen Breyer, which is about as an odd couple as you can get on the court.
Apparently, the dissent, which was written by Clarence Thomas, is epic.
Yes, Clarence Thomas is known for writing lengthy dissents, but what I love about this is the pairing of him and Stephen Breyer. Those are about as an odd couple as you can get on the Supreme Court. I feel like it's a sitcom in the making.
Viacom does not want you watching TV on your iPad, even in your own home. Even when you own a cable subscription that costs between $100 to $200 a month, and even when the streaming of the video only works within a few feet of your house. That's the gist of a lawsuit Viacom is bringing against Cablevision for its app that allows streaming of TV in your home and onto a mobile device like the iPad so you can sit on your patio or lounge in the library and watch TV at the same time. Viacom says it's a new platform. Cablevision says it's like adding a TV screen in a second bedroom and nothing new at all. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. This is going to have to be resolved in the courts. These companies are going to fight it out bitterly. I think Viacom is in the wrong.
I think
they should be trying to make it available on iPad wherever you are. They shouldn't worry about the fact that you're even 100 feet away from your home. So I think they're wrong in every possible way. How many times are you supposed to pay to access television? You need to pay $200 a month. You're supposed to pay $400, $600? It's ridiculous.
I agree. Darn it. Get Clarence Thomas on this. You know, what with the Viacom and Cablevision hoo-ha going on, and this next story, the clouds are getting awfully crowded. The world's biggest electronics chain, Best Buy, is joining Amazon and Google and Apple with its own cloud-based music service. Called My Music Anywhere, it's been available in the UK for more than a year, and now they're bringing it to the US. It offers streaming of music you own to numerous devices, including BlackBerries and Android-based systems, and is most like Amazon's offering. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. We already have a lot of competitors in this business. I couldn't find out how successful it was in the UK, but, you know, more competitors, the better for consumers.
And you know what? I couldn't find it online anywhere. I looked for it all over the place. I went to Best Buy's website, couldn't find it.
That's telling. You mean it for the US or do you mean for the UK?
Doesn't matter. I couldn't find it anywhere.
Oh, okay.
Are your electric bills going through the roof? Don't blame the summer heat. Blame your cable company and the power-guzzling set-top box sitting in your living room. It turns out those little puppies run 24 hours a day and can consume more electricity than new refrigerators and even some central air conditioning units, according to the New York Times and a study that they cite. Easy fixes can cut power usage in half or two-thirds, but cable companies can't be bothered with that, and they think users would rebel if they had to wait 45 seconds for their box to power up. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a very big deal. As one of my friends pointed out, new refrigerators don't use a lot of electricity. They can run for an entire year and only cost about $50 in that time. But if you can easily cut that in half or two-thirds, then you should.
Right,
you know,
I agree.
Half the homes in the country have a set-top box. They're all draining power. You know, anything we can do to decrease power consumption is a good idea. And, you know, first time of the day, turn on the TV for 40 seconds. I think I'll survive.
Yeah, 160 million set-top boxes, one for every two people in the U.S. And I've been wondering when this issue was going to rear its ugly head, because really it's all about the software and optimizing the software and allowing the hardware to go into idle status. And they never allow that in the current software.
Right, they go into idle status, which means they dim the clock, but it just keeps consuming as much energy as ever. So you feel like it's in sleep mode, but it's not really.
Right. What do celebrities who have conquered the world of Hollywood do for fun? They play high-stakes poker, of course. Some of them played high-stakes poker against a 2-bit investor who ran a Ponzi scheme and bilked customers out of millions. Because he spent some of those millions on these private poker games against celebrities like Tobey Maguire and Gabe Kaplan, the investors are suing. They claim the poker games were illegal and therefore the winners have no right to keep the money. Kaplan points out in one interview that the con artist was so convincing as a high roller, although he was a below-average poker player, that a number of celebs actually invested in his fund. Maybe they could sue themselves. So is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. It's not even embarrassing, really, for the celebrities. I guess it's just, you know, who likes to have private info come out. But, I mean, the guy lost $5 million over a few years playing this weekly poker game. No wonder he was welcome among all the other celebrities.
Yeah, apparently Ben Affleck took part in these games, and everybody knows that Tobey Maguire is a huge poker player, so this is no big shock. And everybody knew that he was a part of kind of an ongoing poker tournament or poker game that took place in various places in Los Angeles, but that's legal. You can do that legally so long as no house makes money from it.
That's right. So it's just a little embarrassing.
Right. Now, I'm just glad my daughters never come to me and say this, "Daddy, I want an Oscar-winning screenwriter to pen my film debut and make her pretty, too. That might be what actor Will Smith heard from his daughter Willow. After his son Jada delivered a smash hit with The Karate Kid, Willow is being groomed for a new version of the musical Annie. And Smith is talking with Oscar-winning actress and screenwriter Emma Thompson to write the script. No word yet on whether they're sweetening the deal by asking Thompson to play the boozing head of the orphanage, Miss Hannigan, although that would be good casting. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, given the success of the Smith family, I guess it's a big deal.
That's true.
Annie has not been turned into a good movie musical. There was a good TV version of it a few years ago. They're bringing it back to Broadway in 2012. They just had auditions in New York with about 1,400 little girls belting out Tomorrow, and thank God I didn't have to sit through that. But they don't have to do that for this movie because Willow gets the role, and you know, it's due for an overhaul. And I love that it's Will Smith and Jay-Z involved in producing the film, because Jay-Z had a really big early hit with A Hard Knock Life from the musical Annie worked into one of his raps. It's one of the, I think, signature tunes that really broadened his audience and showed the reach that he would have.
Yeah, it's a big hit for him. Actor John Krasinski of The Office lives near the famed Chateau Marmont, the fabled Hollywood hotel where everyone from Greta Garbo to John Belushi has holed up at one time or another. Krasinski has so many meetings there, he feels like it's his living room, and one day suddenly had the idea to do a miniseries that would tell the story of Hollywood as seen through the Chateau Marmont. Aaron Sorkin, the writer, has committed to writing the screenplay, and HBO is set to commit to the miniseries, which could be 8 hours long and stuffed with stars. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, anything HBO does is a big deal, I guess. You know, they have such a good standard of quality. You know, it's a actor gets role or actor creates project. Good for him. But, you know, we'll have to see how it teams up. It's certainly a promising start.
Rapper 50 Cent is writing a novel. The first person semi-autobiographical tale is about bullying. Wait, the famously tough hip-hop star who has shot who's been shot multiple times but couldn't be killed and was pushed around as a kid is writing this book? Not exactly. 50 Cent's book is about how kids become bullies, not how they get bullied. It's due out in January, and Mr. Cent hopes it helps kids like his own teenage son. Is this a big deal or a big whoop? And do you have to call him Mr. Cent, or can you just call him Fitty?
That was my little inside jokes for the New York Times readers, because they once debated what to refer to Meatloaf as, and they ended up calling him Mr. Loaf, which is one of my favorite names ever. But 50 Cent, of course, was not pushed around as a kid. He was the one doing the pushing around, which is why this book makes sense coming from him. It's not a big deal, but it'll be interesting to see what he does. You know, he's not a great rapper, frankly. You know, he had some really good early hits, but he's not an enduring rap artist as far as I'm concerned. Maybe this is, you know, something that he can deliver on.
In shockingly unshocking news, actor Jon Hamm has re-upped on the role of a lifetime. The character of Don Draper in AMC's Mad Men for what amounts to the final 3 years of the series. After lengthy negotiations with character, or I should say, with creator Matthew Weiner, finally resolved themselves, Lionsgate turned to its star, giving Hamm a substantial raise that will bring his take close to $250,000 an episode by the end of the show's run. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. Everybody knew it would happen. I never thought they wouldn't make a deal with Matthew Weiner. He's not had great success outside the show yet. We're still waiting for him to have a breakthrough, substantial role. He's been in some, you know, big films and stuff, but not really a big role that he can really claim as his own. So, you know, it was just inevitable. I don't know. The New York Times referred to him as $250,000, making him one of the highest paid stars in television. I don't think that's true at all. I don't think that's even close. Especially if you include reality and the fact that this show only runs 12 episodes a season. And that's at the end of this run. So after 7 seasons, he'll make like $4 million in the final season. I don't think that's even close to being one of the highest paid stars in TV, but that's just me.
Well, you did such a great job with the Tonys there and Broadway. Maybe just
mocking me, aren't you?
No, I'm going to ask you to go and ask all the actors how much they're making.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
One by one, please.
Well, we know that people on The X Factor and The American Idol make a lot more money than that. We know that people, you know, we know that Charlie Sheen was making like, what was it, $1.1 million per episode?
$750,000 plus with the back end, it came up to like $1.2 million. Yeah.
Right. So that's 24 episodes in a year or 26, or, you know, it's well more than, you know, the 12 that Jon Hamm was making. So it's just not even close.
Singer Glenn Campbell has Alzheimer's, but that isn't stopping him from touring. The voice behind Wichita Lineman and Gentle on My Mind has a new album out in August that mostly contains covers a la Johnny Cash. He'll be doing a goodbye tour while he can still perform on stage and not flub too many lyrics. His wife is glad he told people about the illness, so fans wouldn't think Campbell, who was arrested for drunk driving a few years ago, was just imbibing again. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. I mean, I didn't know Peter Falk had Alzheimer's. There was somebody else recently that I heard about having Alzheimer's. Glenn Campbell's dealing with it. I think it's great that he's out in public about it and taking a sort of a farewell tour, you know, rather than being invisible. You know, he'll be there. His fans will support him, get one last hurrah. It's going to be kind of touching. And he's, you know, a pretty interesting artist who's had a long career.
Yes, like a rhinestone cowboy.
Exactly.
Keith Olbermann is backing down. The famously determined and bullheaded, in a good way, TV commentator had announced that his show on Current TV would almost always run long and bleed right into the 9 p.m. hour. After a barrage of tweets and online protests, Olbermann quickly rescinded the plan and said the show would end at 9 p.m., rather than conflicting with the start of Rachel Maddow's show over on MSNBC. Quote, "Thanks for upsiding my head on this," said Olbermann. "Is this a huge deal or a big whoop?"
I think it's a huge deal, not just because of the relationship Keith Olbermann had with Rachel Maddow, which made it tacky, but I find this incredibly frustrating on all television. I hate it when shows run to like 9:03 or 10:02. It just drives me nuts because it makes it very impossible to tape other shows on that network or other networks. Suddenly, you know, everything gets messed up on your DVRing. It's a total pain in the neck. It's really annoying. I end up having to tape over 3 or 4 minutes for some shows like The Daily Show so I don't miss the end joke. It's just very, you know, end the show when you're supposed to end it. It's really, really annoying to me. And the era where they bleed into the next show and so you're never going to change the channel. I'm sorry, I'm not even watching television. I DVR it. So end, stop this now. And I think it's incredibly frustrating. I think a lot of people hate it and it drives them nuts.
I don't think I've ever seen the end of, what's the name of that show? Modern Family.
Right, exactly. And networks have to realize it's a new environment and they're ticking their customers off. It really, really drives me nuts. And if you want to tape the end of Modern Family, suddenly now you've recorded one show in the 9:30 slot, which means you can't tape another show. You know, you can only tape one other show rather than two. It just has this cascading series of problems. I think it's a huge annoyance to people. And if networks paid attention at all to how their customers actually feel, they would never, ever do this.
I agree. But that does conclude Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week, and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, our segment where we discuss the stories that only people in Hollywood might care about. And this week we have two stories that are somewhat related and both about piracy. PayPal is shutting down accounts of online retailers that are selling pirated DVDs. Most of these sites are in Asia and China.
Hello, China. I bet you're not pirating the new film playing in the theaters about the birth of the Communist Party.
Yeah, I wonder if they are.
I bet they're not.
Yeah, I mean, it's always been widely known that, you know, on the streets of Beijing, you can go out and buy whatever's in the theater for a dollar. And some of them are really good copies, too.
You can do that all over Asia, Hong Kong, elsewhere. Yeah.
Yeah. And so now PayPal is saying, that's great, but you can't do it online anymore because we're cracking down. And it was the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America's Asia Pacific office in Singapore, that helped get PayPal to do this.
Well, I think this is a good thing. When you know somebody is running a business with illegal stuff, you shouldn't allow them on your website to use your financial services. You know, you shouldn't let the Medellin cartel sell drugs via PayPal. There's no reason to allow companies you know are pirating in, you know, stolen film or music or books or whatever it might be to use your website for their financial services. This is very different from targeting an individual who's downloading something. You know, we're talking about a business stealing in pirated copyrighted material.
Okay, so you moved us right along into probably the bigger story and maybe one of the biggest stories of the week in tech and entertainment, which is that some of the ISPs, the internet service providers in the US, are finally going to begin adopting a graduated response to piracy. And this was a story that was an exclusive on CNET. Graduated response, do you know what that is, Michael?
Well, I can guess that, you know, they start with one step and then another stronger step and another stronger step.
Right. I mean, for years, the entertainment industry, both through the MPAA, the RIAA, and IFP over in, is it IFP in Europe? Well, basically trade organizations, entertainment trade organizations, have been trying to get internet service providers to kick people off the internet who are pirating music and movies.
Right. If you're a college student and you're downloading albums and they track you down, they want them to just pull the plug and not let you on the internet ever again.
It's been made a little bit harder by the UN saying that, you know, it's a basic human right to have internet access. But
Tell it to my cable provider. This sucker is slow.
Well, finally, there are groups inside the U.S. who have long since said we cannot do that. We cannot like packet sniff our customers' traffic and create a third strikes law where the first strike, you know, you're given a warning, and the second one, you're told that if it happens again, you're off the internet, which in France they did have for a while, and in Europe, some European countries they did have. Now, AT&T, Comcast, and Verizon, all of whom are big ISPs here in the U.S., are going to be working with the media and entertainment companies to prevent piracy.
So basically what they do is they say, hey, you shouldn't do that, and then maybe they slow down your bandwidth speed, things like that, or they limit you to, say, 200 of the top websites.
Right. So if they see that you're pirating, then they can throttle you, as you mentioned, slow down your connection if they think you're pirating. They could make you take a class on copyright and intellectual property so that you could learn all about that and why it's important.
The only thing I don't understand is how they decide who to target, who determines that, who provides the list, who decides who to start with or how. You know, I mean, there are obviously millions of people who perhaps have downloaded illegal stuff online, not myself included, frankly. But how do they decide who to start with?
And there's the rub. The way they do this is they packet sniff. They look at the traffic that's coming through, and they examine all the bits bit by bit, and they say, wow, this person's sending a lot of a certain type of traffic through. They must be downloading or uploading music illegally. We'll throttle them. So it's kind of like I've heard it compared to taking a bus, and what the entertainment industry wants the bus driver to do is ask everyone getting on the bus, what are you going to do? Why are you taking the bus? Oh, you're going to school. Okay, hop on. But when the person shows up and says, well, I'm going to the bank so I can rob it, then they want the bus driver to arrest that person.
Well, I mean, they need to try. I mean, nowadays with the threat of charging people for their bandwidth usage, you know, and having a cap on your monthly usage, they're tracking already who's using how much bandwidth.
Right.
And they can tell the people that are downloading, you know, 100 Hollywood movies a month versus the people who are, you know, streaming Netflix 2 hours a week.
You know, most people would want their internet connection to be a dump pipe, just data in, mm-hmm. data out. Nobody's looking at it, period. Instead, what they're doing is saying, no, we're going to be looking and examining all the data coming in and out. And, you know, it's also been compared to, you know, the phone company arresting people planning, you know, a murder over phone lines. How would the phone company know unless they were listening in?
I see. That's interesting. Well, we'll have to see how they try to implement it and what rules they come up with, and whether it, I'm sure somebody will challenge it constitutionally, and we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah, well, if it's challenged constitutionally and gets shot down, the cable companies and the ISPs, they're going to be in for a world of hurt because they won't be able to do a lot of things like data caps.
Yeah, well, I pray that they're not able to do data caps.
Oh, it's coming.
It's coming, but I hope it gets challenged, or I hope people fight it off, or I hope people switch to providers that don't do it. I'm about to renew with Time Warner Cable, and I'm going to call them up and ask them about data caps.
They're the only ones that haven't said anything about it so far.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of caps, we should probably cap our show. I know I mentioned some listener email, but I'm going to hold that off for next week, and it's about the...
Don't tease it.
Okay, I'm not going to tease it. We'll read the listener email next week. In fact, we can read your email if you email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. We can also play your voicemail if you call us and leave us one. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Now, you can find that and links to all of the stories we've discussed, plus all of our past episodes, plus ways to subscribe to our podcast. And I do suggest you subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. You can subscribe in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or in your RSS reader. All of this information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. Now, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT, and they can be found either on MySpace, if that's still around, or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz, thank you very much for joining us this week. You're on michaelgiltz.com. Chris Baker is at both I Love Chris Baker and I Hate Chris Baker.com.
And I feel the same way depending on the day of the week. You never know how you'll feel about Chris Baker.
That's true. And I'd like to thank him for joining us. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.